everybody. I'm Michelle Martin at NPR. Welcome to NPR Rough Cuts. We're working on a new daily interview and talk show, and we need your help. We want this show to be fresh, unpredictable, and real. We're dedicated to seeking out diverse perspectives, showcasing new voices, and opening up dialogue from around the world. We want to talk about issues in all their complexity, and we need your help to make the show the best that it can be. So we invite you to listen to our weekly offerings and tell us what you think. To read our weekly weblogs and to post your feedback, please log on to npr.org/roughcuts. Now, on with the program. By now, you've probably heard about Oprah Winfrey's new school for girls, a leadership academy in South Africa. It's a $40 million campus south of Johannesburg, equipped with state-of-the-art classrooms, a theater, a library, and, yes, a beauty salon and yoga studio. What you may not have heard is that private citizens have been doing the same thing, building and supporting schools overseas out of their own, not Oprah-sized pockets. We're calling them Ordinary Oprahs. Today, we meet two of them, Lydia Schaefer and Wendy Johnson. Later, we'll hear from the head of a nonprofit that helps match small donors with projects overseas. But first, Lydia, you work at a salon in downtown Washington doing nails and skincare, and you managed to build a school in your native Ethiopia virtually on your own. Well, what made you decide to build a school?
I adopted four children when the wars end, and the little girl when I adopted when she was 2 years old, when she started school when she was six, you know, it's 3 hours walking to the school. And she got hit by a hyena. She fell asleep down the road.
Wait a minute. Let me just make sure I understand this. She had to walk 3 hours to get to school.
Yeah.
And she paused to rest one day and was attacked by a hyena?
Yeah. Sunset in the evening, in the afternoon.
Did she survive?
No, she died.
And it made a big impression on you, and because you went to that school yourself.
I was always thought I was going to build a school for them, but then it happened that really pushed my button. And then I said, you know, I can build school right in the centers when everybody can walk an hour, maybe 2 hour, hour and a half. It's not fancy, but it's in the center where everybody can get to it.
How much did it cost?
Well, it's actually just building. I mean, it doesn't have any equipment inside. So it cost me $258,000.
Dollars?
Dollars.
American dollars?
A dollar. Mm-hmm.
Lydia, may I ask, did you have $258,000?
No,
just
but,
sitting around someplace?
No, but it took me 10 years. 10 years, and I sold my house because I did give my work to those children. I don't own a car. I don't own anything. I live basic. So I budget with myself. So all my clients for the salon, they donate $50,000 with the windows and doors.
That's an amazing story.
Yeah.
Lydia, thank you. We're also joined by Wendy Johnson, who works as an administrative assistant right here at NPR. Wendy, for more than a decade, you've been supporting projects in Ethiopia and Ghana. Now, you told me you started going to Africa in 1996. What drew you there?
Well, actually, my sister had been a few times to the continent, and she came back, and she just raved about it, and I just decided one day that I was going to go. Every year, since 1996, that's the only place I've really been on vacation. This past year, I was in Ghana, and we visit schools as well as, you know, we'll visit the slave castles and do, you know, historical tours, that type of thing, but we always, always go to a village school, one or two, wherever we are in whatever country. I'm going back to Ghana in March. I'll be taking about 30 people with me, and we're going to go back to the same school and deliver supplies and maybe some clothes, personal items, and, of course, monetary donations.
And as I understand it, you never go overseas without several barrels of supplies, clothing, school supplies,
right.
Sometimes some, you know, treats for the kids. How
right.
do you do it?
Well, I have to do a lot of shopping for sales. I shop a lot of times after the holidays, like after Christmas, things become 75 or 90% off, and you can get little baby outfits for $2 or $3, actually. And I hold fundraisers where people come, and I have a silent auction. In my past trips to Africa, I've purchased a lot of wood carvings, you know, drums, art, that type of thing, and I auction them off, and that money I turn around and use to go back.
And you even went so far as to found a nonprofit in order to support these efforts.
Yes, it's Age of Awareness, and we do have a website at ageofawareness.org.
Okay. I'd like to bring into the conversation Dennis Whittle. He's the co-founder of Global Giving. It's a nonprofit founded in 2000 that supports small sometimes and big projects. So currently supporting about 400 projects in 70 countries right now, as I understand it. Your group has been described as the eBay of giving. Explain.
Well, I think several people have called it that. And if you think about the Internet, it's really changing everything. First, it changed shopping with Amazon and eBay. And then it changed search and information with Google, and then music with iTunes. And now the Internet's really changing philanthropy. And that's where Global Giving is trying to make a difference.
How does it work?
It works when people, amazing people like Lydia and Wendy, who we're talking here, who we call social entrepreneurs and are doing amazing things, can list projects on Global Giving. And it enables other people to come and support them. And if you think about the stories we're hearing today, these are two amazing people who are struggling mostly by themselves to get this done. The mission of Global Giving is to help people like Lydia and Wendy attract support from throughout the United States and throughout the world. So the way it works is people like them list projects, and anyone in the world basically can come on and see the projects and contribute and support the efforts that they're undertaking.
Now I've asked each Lydia and Wendy what motivated them to get started doing this work, so I'd like to ask you.
I spent most of my early career, over 14 years at the World Bank, doing giant multi-hundred-million-dollar projects. And while I'm proud of everything I did there, sometimes I wondered what the impact of such giant projects was. You frequently didn't see the direct impact. And so in the late 90s, I was asked by the president of the World Bank to just experiment with small-scale project funding. And we began to look for people who were doing small projects, $50,000 projects. And we found these extraordinary people like Lydia and Wendy all around the world. And so my co-founder and I got this idea to create this eBay-like marketplace where people like that could list their projects and anybody in the world could fund them.
How do people find their way to you, and how much money do you have to contribute to participate in your organization?
Some people just find us through Google search whenever there's a crisis. We also work through major companies such as Yahoo, eBay, Google, Hewlett-Packard, Applied Materials, The Gap, The North Face, all of whom promote it to their employees and their customers. I like the theme of the show that anyone can be an Oprah. It's really true that $10 or $50 can make a huge difference in the lives of people around the world. And specifically with respect to education, on average, $50 can keep one child in school in most countries in Africa. So the minimum is $10. $50 is kind of a sweet spot. Obviously, people contribute what they can.
You look at the news coming from many of the countries of interest, and it just seems so terrible and so overwhelming. And people think, I'd love to help, but you know, what can I possibly do? But then the second hurdle is they want to know if their money's being well spent.
That's right. I think that's right.
So how do you address both those concerns?
Well, the first one, we work with probably, I think, the best and most reputable people and organizations in the world. And so you try to make sure that it's the company you keep that conveys the authenticity. On the side of what happens to your money, this is very important to people. A lot of people have a perception that it's money down a rat hole. Well, that's not true. If you give $50 to Lydia or Wendy, you can be sure that they're probably going to make more than $50 use of your money. So on Global Giving, we allow groups such as theirs to post progress reports and pictures of what's actually happening to the money. And then you, as a donor, get these progress reports emailed to you so you can see and hear what happened. And you can even go back and comment on those progress reports and give ratings to those progress reports and ask further questions and follow up.
Lydia does have some wonderful pictures of the project in Feras Mai and that we will post on our website. Lydia, I wanted to ask, many people would consider your story remarkable enough just as just your own personal journey. I mean, you came here as a child after conflict. And you managed to, you know, buy a house, have two children, raise two children who are sort of living successful lives. And that in itself is for many people the American dream. And then you gave it all up, in essence, and kind of went backwards, stripping down your own life to send that money overseas. And I wonder, do people in the community here, how do they feel about that? Do they applaud you? Do they think you're a little crazy, if you don't mind my asking?
They cannot believe it. Is she serious? She didn't have a car. She didn't have a house. I live with roommate, but believe it or not, I'm happy seeing those children getting education. First of all, when I went over there, I wanted to do two things. I thought it was cheaper. I wanted to open small clinics or school. But the people that live there, so if you open clinics, nobody will run it because there's no education. It will not run right. But if you open the education first, maybe they can read a little bit and they can run. those
clinics or
clinics.
Health clinics. Yeah. How many children are served by the school that you founded?
Right now, the school holds 1,000 children.
1,000 children?
1,000 children. It's 16 classrooms, and they have an administration office. It's not fancy like here when I say administration office. And they have a library, and they have a laboratory for chemistry, and they have conference room.
Wendy, I wanted to ask that Oprah has received, and Des, I want you to weigh in on this too. Oprah has received, I don't know whether it's harsh criticism, I'm not quite sure how to characterize it, but there's kind of a subtext of why are you doing this overseas? You know, are there not needs at home that could be filled by your wealth? I think it is fair to say that Oprah Winfrey has been extremely generous to many, many institutions and projects in the United States. But notwithstanding that, people say, well, why are you sending your money overseas? Do you feel that your dollar goes further, that you can see more of an impact?
Much more of an impact and even appreciation. I've gone to countries where we've lost track of the days and we want to go to a school and our driver would say, well, it's Saturday, but the kids will come out. They've come out to get their pens, pencils. Sometimes we give them jeans, clothes, that type of thing on a Saturday or a Sunday. And it's packed.
Dennis, what about you? I don't know if you've ever, in your peer group, ever experienced that that criticism or if you've heard it from sort of the broader sort of donor community. And what would you say to that?
I can only speak from my personal experience. I live in the inner city here in Washington, and I work with a lot of kids in the alley playing basketball, tutoring them, et cetera, and spend a lot of time with them as well as my work overseas. So my answer is both. It requires a little bit of both. It's not either or. I can spend $50 to buy a new pair of basketball shoes for the kid in the alley here in Washington, which is nice. And I can spend $50 and send a child to school for a year in Ethiopia. So the bang for the buck, if you will, is absolutely huge.
You know, you've each given a very great deal of your own resources, time, and passion to the things that engage you. I wanted to ask, what have each of you gotten? Lydia, do you want to start?
Oh, I don't know how to express this, what I have. It's not in a material way that I get it back. It's how I feel inside.
And Wendy?
I say the same thing. I feel the same way. It's just, it's a blessing for me. I feel totally blessed by doing this. And you feel really, really good about it. I just wish that I could do more.
And Dennis?
Yeah, I think most people would characterize it as a sacrifice. But when you see these kids going to school in Ethiopia, as Lydia does, and running around and having a good time and learning, it's the most gratifying thing you could do.
Okay. Lydia Schaefer, Wendy Johnson, two ordinary Oprahs who have built and supported educational projects overseas. Thank you for joining us so much.
And thank you for having me.
And Dennis Will, he's the co-founder of Global Giving, a philanthropic organization that matches donors with projects overseas. Thank you also for joining
us. Thanks for having me.
Oprah Winfrey has been highly praised for her efforts to educate girls in South Africa, but she's also been criticized for channeling her philanthropic dollars to African children when there are so many children here in need in the United States. We're joined now by Jean Sperling, a leading economist, who says there is no better investment in the world's future than educating girls in Africa. He is director of the Center for Universal Education at the Council on Foreign Relations, a former head of the National Economic Council in the Clinton administration, and he's co-author of a report published by the council called What Works in Girls' Education. Jean, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Of course, it's important to educate children overall. So why the special emphasis on girls in the developing world?
Well, it is important to recognize that education is the silent crisis in the developing world for both boys and girls. Boys are out of school, not in as greater proportions, but it is important to realize it's a general problem. But it is also important to recognize that there are both special obstacles and special benefits for girls going to school. Parents often in poor countries have to pay fees to send their kids to school. What many parents do in that case is they get the fees to send their two oldest boys. It is their girls who get left out. They may fear that their girls will marry into other families. It's their boys who will support them. So girls, particularly poor rural girls in Africa, are the worst off in education anywhere in the world. But yet here's the striking part. It's been shown study after study that investment in education in these girls may be the single highest return of any investment we can make.
Why?
Well, the reason why is that we've always known that in Africa as well as the United States, an extra year of education can add 10% to your wages lifetime. But what studies have shown is that educating girls has a much broader impact. Educated girls are less likely significantly to contract AIDS. They are more likely, as parents, to have smaller, healthier families. Every year a girl is educated reduces by about 10% the chances that her baby will die as an infant. So, you know, education really becomes the foundation, and also for women's empowerment. You know, there's problems everywhere in the world, but in terms of promoting democracy, reducing domestic violence, studies have shown educating girls does more to promote healthier families, stronger democracies. So you just could not have a wiser, better bang for your buck investment in terms of social return, in terms of economics, and also in terms of our morality.
You pointed out that parents sometimes, when faced with limited resources, will have a preference for educating the boys over the girls because the boys are more likely to support them in their old age, and the boys just have more earning power. So isn't that a rational economic decision for those parents to make? And what can you do about that?
Well, this is a perfect question, because the truth is educating a girl is unquestionably good for that, for the country as a whole, and it's unquestionably good for that girl. But the real question is what's best for the parents? And this is where smart public policy matters. If you can help align the incentives of the parents with the incentives of the girl, then what you'll find almost all the time is the parents will choose what's best for their child's future. But as you said, you know, you have to be sympathetic to these parents. These are parents in extreme poverty. They're relying on their girls not only to take care of the younger children, but to get firewood, to get water, the basics of support. And they do, unfortunately, rely more on the girls than the boys to do that. Culturally, in some countries, you hear this horrible expression, educating your girl is like watering your neighbor's garden. She's going to marry into someone else's family. It's not true in all countries, but it is in many. Now, what can you do? Well, one, in most poor countries in the world, you have to pay a fee to go to public school. That fee can be 20-30% of your entire family income if you have 3-4 children. So you make school free. Secondly, keep schools close by. Parents are particularly worried about their girls being attacked by, to be honest, men, being sexually molested. So keeping schools close, letting them see the school itself, these are things that really matter. Now, what's been done in a lot of places that's been very effective, and we see this in Brazil, we've seen U.S. programs in Ethiopia and other places, Egypt and Bangladesh, where you give a small stipend to the parents. You actually say, in Brazil they say, you actually get a small stipend if your children go have 90% attendance. Well, that changes the economic incentive. Now the family can say, yes, we're in extreme poverty, but if we send our girl to school, we're not only building her future, we're not having to sacrifice that lost income, that lost help that we need.
What do you say to people who argue that this is Western interference in local cultures?
Well, two comments. First is, I think it is incredibly important to always be listening to the wants and needs and desires of people in the countries you're dealing with, and not to be just imposing your will. That said, let me tell you, you go anywhere in the world, and girls and boys want to learn. They want an education. And I think, and this is, I think, one of the things you hear Oprah say, which is that when you go into a classroom in places where children don't have the luxury of complaining that they have homework or complaining about their teacher, you see a hunger to learn, a hunger for education. So I think virtually anybody who's worked in this knows that the hunger for education, for self-empowerment, self-improvement, is universal. It's a universal right, but even more, I think it is an inherent desire of all people.
What do you make of the criticism of Oprah School that it's too luxurious?
You know, the way I look at it is the following. In the United States, every day, a wealthy person endows a privileged alma mater of theirs for privileged children. Oprah Winfrey goes out and endows a privileged school for the most underprivileged children in the world, girls whose families make under $800 a year. You know, I think that's a wonderful thing. When people see some of the poorest girls in Africa getting some of the opportunities that many of us are lucky to get here, and we see them on her show 3 or 4 years from now just blowing us away, you know, that's going to say to everybody, that the only difference between us and some of the poorest children in the world is just the accident of birth, the opportunities we have, and there's an enormous ability to level that and have more opportunity if we can provide everyone at least a quality basic education.
Gene Sperling is the director of the Center for Universal Education at the Council on Foreign Relations. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Now it's your turn. We wanted to put our stamp on a big national story. Did you like this approach? What else would you like to hear about this topic? With the second segment, we wanted to offer greater context to the issue of investing in girls' education. Did we succeed? And is this the kind of discussion that would motivate you to call or write in? Tell us what you think. Please visit the NPR Rough Cuts page on the web at npr.org/roughcuts. This is Michelle Martin. I'll talk to you next week.